Texas, which is only about 3.5% of Texas's 29 million. Well, and not only that, only a fraction of them would actually stay in Texas, which is another issue. Yeah, listen, Andrew, it's not, none of it's logical. None of it's logical. You can try to present, empirical data to these folks. It doesn't make a difference. If they've decided it's an invasion of Haitian migrants, as Trump said, who have AIDS, as other Republicans have said, who will, you know, suck the country dry of resources, whatever. If they've convinced themselves of that, no data that you present is going to change their minds. That's fundamentally what it comes down to. And at this point, it shouldn't come as a big shock. We've got a great bonus show planned for you today. There's another show every day. We do the 1 hour broadcast show podcast. That's this that you're listening to, watching right now, excuse me. And then we do an additional bonus show just for our members. You can sign up at joinpacman.com. Use the coupon code felony21. It's such a big discount. It should be a felony. I think actually Ted Cruz wants to make it one, but we're pushing against that. Big discount, felony21. JoinPacman.com.
Things get brighter day by day when you listen to the Big W. Life is lighter in every way when you listen to the Big W. So laugh it up and let yourself go with King Size Radio, the Big WRCT, Radio Carnegie Tech.
Arr, I'm from creationist crucifixion.
Arr, I'm not attractive and I'm from Steel Curtain.
Me neither, arr.
WRCT.
Pittsburgh, 88.3, arr.
Hey, this is Tom from the band Loose, and you are listening to 88.3 WRCT, Pittsburgh.
WRCT, this is the place that sets the pace for Pittsburgh.
WRCT, Pittsburgh, we won't respect you in the morning.
WRCT, Pittsburgh, we love monkeys.
Hovland, you're listening to 88.3 WRCT FM, Pittsburgh.
Pittsburgh. RCT Pittsburgh, meaty and full of flavor since 1949.
Senator John McCain, and I'm from Arizona. But when I'm in Pittsburgh, I always listen to WRCT, one of the finest stations in all of radio. And Carnegie Mellon University is one of the finest academic institutions in our country. Be sure at your next election to vote early and vote often.
You're listening to WRCT Feedback Radio.
WRCT Radio 900.
Hi, we are Microwaves, reminding you that the most important things in life are to crush your enemies,
to see them driven before you,
and to hear the lamentations of their women while listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM.
Hi, this is Felicia Collins from Late Show with David Letterman, and you are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh.
Listening to WRCT Pittsburgh's Radio Automation. Please stay tuned for more incredible tracks from our extensive, vast, libidinous, and
balls.
Awesome. I called it libidinous. That doesn't make any. I mean it.
Hey there, folks. Glad you could join me for all the best, the smoothest of the smooth, the cool and gentle sounds of what we call jazz.
Tired of the fluffy stuff? At WRCT Pittsburgh, jazz is a one-song word.
This is Ziggy Marley, and you're listening to WRCT in Pittsburgh, you know? Go Steelers.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
WRCT Pittsburgh. The last bastion of pulchritude.
Yo, there's only 6 degrees of separation, and we know 5 people you know.
How much longer did you really think you could avoid strict flow? You're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh 88.3 FM. Like this!
WRCT is the best place to be. He sends the music out your way 40 hours every day.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
The IPCC report in August was a wake-up call for all of us. It made clear that the lights are flashing red on the climate dashboard.
The UN Climate Summit has opened in Glasgow, Scotland. It's being called the last best hope to tackle the climate emergency.
It's such a crucial turning point, and at COP, I want to see action, enough of the empty promises. We have to see action in line with 1.5 degrees targets, which countries haven't met since they signed the Paris Agreement.
We'll speak to leading climate activists in England and Scotland. Plus, look at how this year's climate summit may be the whitest and most privileged one ever, with thousands from the global south unable to attend because of lack of access to COVID vaccines and visa issues. We'll go to Mozambique to speak to a longtime climate campaigner who had to stay home. Plus, we'll look at the shocking future torture of a former U.S. resident in CIA black sites. Military jurors who heard him testify at Guantanamo say his treatment is a, quote, stain on the moral fiber of America. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. World leaders and activists have arrived in Glasgow, Scotland for COP26, the critical United Nations summit aimed at averting the most catastrophic effects of the climate emergency. A recent UN emissions gap report showed current contributions and commitments by nations to reduce emissions are not nearly enough to avert a planetary disaster. This is UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres.
There is a serious risk that Glasgow will not deliver. Several recent climate announcements might leave the impression of a rosier picture. Unfortunately, this is an illusion. The current national determined contributions, formal commitments by governments, still condemn the world to a calamitous 2.7 degree increase. There are serious questions of credibility. We see dangerous levels of mistrust among the big powers, among members of the G20, between developed and developing countries.
Some 30,000 people are expected to take part in the two-week summit, which was postponed for a year due to the pandemic. Climate activists have been gathering in Glasgow to push world leaders to take more drastic action, like ending government subsidies for fossil fuels and divesting from coal, oil and gas.
So we know that our whole financial system at the moment is embroiled with the fossil fuel industry, and we need to find a way to get out of that and to move the money into climate solutions rather than the causes of climate change.
After headlines, we'll go to Glasgow for the latest on the COP26 climate summit, and stay with us for this next 2 weeks as we bring you comprehensive coverage of the summit from inside, outside, and around the world for those who couldn't show up in Glasgow. President Biden and others traveled to Glasgow after attending this weekend's G20 summit in Italy, where world leaders agreed to a minimum corporate tax rate of 15%. The deal also raises additional revenue for most countries and shifts profits to the countries where companies sell products to consumers rather than where the companies are based. Studies indicate the deal will benefit high-income countries, including the U.S., the most. On the climate front, G20 members agreed to work towards ending coal financing overseas and pledged to pursue efforts to keep the global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels, as per the Paris Agreement, but made no firm commitments to that end. Activists held protests in Rome throughout the weekend.
We are holding a demonstration on environmental and social issues and against the G20, which continues undaunted on a path that has almost led us to social and ecological failure.
G20 members also backed an extension of debt relief for poorer nations and pledged to vaccinate 70% of the global population against COVID-19 by the middle of next year. G20 countries have received three times more vaccine doses per person than all other countries combined, and 15 times more COVID vaccine doses per person than sub-Saharan African nations. Over 5 million people around the world have died of COVID-19. This according to a tally of reported deaths kept by Johns Hopkins University. Though some estimates put the actual death toll at more than twice that number, the staggering milestone comes roughly 20 months after the WHO declared COVID-19 a pandemic and amidst persistent global vaccine inequity and a hugely uneven recovery. Here in the United States, the Food and Drug Administration granted emergency use authorization for Pfizer-BioNTech's coronavirus vaccine in children 5 to 11. The Centers for Disease Control is expected to swiftly sign off on the move, making the shots available for some 28 million children as early as this week. In legal news, the U.S. Supreme Court on Friday rejected a religious objection to Maine's vaccine mandate by healthcare workers. Meanwhile, a federal appeals court in New York ruled the state could move ahead with its vaccine mandate for health workers. This comes as over 26,000 New York City government workers, including firefighters, police officers, and sanitation workers, missed a deadline to get vaccinated and are facing unpaid leave starting today. Over 2,000 firefighters have taken medical leave in the past week as the vaccine deadline approached. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki tested positive for the coronavirus Sunday, 5 days after her last in-person meeting with President Biden. She says she and Biden met outside, were both wearing masks, and were socially distanced. She's fully vaccinated and is reporting only mild symptoms. In immigration news, the Biden administration's issued a new memo in an attempt to end the Trump-era migrant protection protocols, also known as Remain in Mexico, which forces asylum seekers to wait in Mexico while their cases make their way through U.S. courts. After taking office, Biden rescinded the program, but a court ruling revived the policy in August. In related news, a caravan of mostly Central American and Caribbean asylum seekers traveling from southern Mexico to the northern border had to take a brief pause on their journey as a number of travelers, including young children, face health problems and exhaustion from the arduous journey. This is a Cuban migrant.
The health of the migrants is terrible. People have fever sores on their feet. We are receiving medical attention. Many pregnant women have miscarried on the way and have received medical assistance. The trek is challenging.
Mexican authorities have attempted to negotiate with members of the caravan, but many turned down so-called humanitarian visas in exchange for ending their trek, saying they didn't trust the offer due to past mistreatment. In other news from Mexico, a gunman shot and killed journalist Freddy Lopez Arevalo at his home in the southern state of Chiapas. The longtime reporter worked for a number of outlets covering politics in Central America and the Zapatista uprising in Chiapas, among other topics. He's at least the ninth journalist to be murdered this year in Mexico. In Yemen, at least 10 people were killed and over 24 injured Sunday, including children, after Houthi rebels fired ballistic missiles into a religious school and mosque in the central province of Marib. The attack came one day after a powerful explosion tore through the gate to Aden's International Airport, killing at least 12 people and wounding many others. Witnesses said the source of the blast was a small truck carrying fuel. It's not known if the explosion was intentional.
The explosion occurred after the Maghreb prayer and injured my two cousins in this grocery store. We have a library and a pharmacy behind the shop, and they killed children and women and terrified passersby and frightened safe people.
The latest violence comes as the United Nations warns more than 20 million Yemenis, or two-thirds of the population, are in need of humanitarian assistance. In Sudan, hundreds of thousands of protesters continue to take to the streets, calling for a reversal of last Monday's coup, which saw Prime Minister Abdalla Hamdok deposed and arrested, his cabinet fired, a joint civilian-military council dissolved. On Saturday, Sudanese soldiers shot and killed three protesters in the city of Omdurman. Hundreds of thousands marched in the capital Khartoum, and other massive rallies were held in cities throughout Sudan. In Uganda, a bomb attack has killed two children. The explosive was reportedly shaped like a jackfruit and was given to the children while they were playing. It's the third bomb attack targeting civilians in Uganda within the past week. The Islamic State claimed responsibility for at least one attack in Kampala last weekend, which killed one person and wounded three others. Ugandan officials say they're investigating a group called the Allied Democratic Forces, which is suspected of ties to ISIS. Back in the U.S., in Texas, a San Antonio area homeowner will use the state's Stand Your Ground laws to defend himself against a murder charge after he shot and killed a motorist who pulled into his driveway, apparently because the driver was lost. 65-year-old Terry Turner, who's white, fatally shot unarmed 31-year-old Adil Dugugi, who was of Moroccan origin, through the driver's side window of his car as Dugugi was turning around in Turner's driveway, pulling his car out. Turner said in an affidavit he believed Dugugi was armed and that he fired his handgun in self-defense. Dugugi's family and attorneys say it took nearly 2 weeks of calls to the Texas Rangers and the state's Department of Justice before police finally arrested Terry Turner. Dugugi was unarmed. Philadelphia has become the first major U.S. city to ban police from stopping cars for low-level traffic violations in an effort to reduce dangerous interactions between racist police officers and motorists of color. Police data from 2018 and 19 showed black drivers represent 72% of traffic stops in Philadelphia, even though black residents only make up 42% of Philadelphia's population. A recent study by the New York Times found police officers across the U.S. have killed over 400 drivers or passengers who were not armed with a deadly weapon in the past 5 years. Only five of those officers have been convicted of crimes. In Buffalo, New York, Starbucks workers have won a significant victory against the coffee chain giant after the National Labor Relations Board ruled three separate Buffalo stores can hold elections on whether to form a union. Starbucks fought to make the whole Buffalo region vote in just one election. Mail-in voting is scheduled to start next week and will run through December 8th. If successful, the three coffee shops would be the first unionized Starbucks stores in the country. And the Supreme Court is hearing arguments today on Texas's new law outlawing most abortions. The majority conservative court is considering challenges from abortion providers and the Biden administration on the nation's strictest anti-choice law, which deputizes private citizens to enforce the abortion ban and violates the constitutional right to an abortion enshrined in Roe v. Wade. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show in Glasgow, Scotland. President Biden and 120 other world leaders are gathering in Glasgow for the start of the UN Climate Summit. The head of the summit, Alok Sharma, said this marks, quote, our last best hope to address the climate emergency and to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius. Sharma spoke Sunday as the summit began.
The IPCC report in August was a wake-up call for all of us. It made clear that the lights are flashing red on the climate dashboard. That report, agreed by 195 governments, makes clear that human activity is unequivocally the cause of global warming.
Leaders of the group of 20 wealthiest nations, which together are responsible for 80% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions, met in Rome ahead of the COP26 climate summit. The G20 leaders pledged to try to limit global temperature rise to 1.5 degrees Celsius, but did not offer specifics on how to achieve that goal. A recent UN emissions gap report showed current contributions and commitments by nations to reduce emissions are not nearly enough to avert a planetary catastrophe. Some 30,000 people are expected to take part in the two-week summit, but many warn Glasgow will be the whitest and most privileged climate summit ever, with thousands from the global south unable to attend because of lack of access to COVID vaccines and visa issues. Climate activists are planning 2 weeks of actions, including a major rally on Saturday. In London, climate activists, including Greta Thunberg, rallied outside the offices of Standard Chartered Bank on Friday to protest financial institutions funding fossil fuel extraction. This is Filipino climate activist Mitzi Jonel Tan.
The Philippines is one of the most climate-vulnerable countries in the world to the climate crisis, and Standard Chartered Bank is fueling most of that destruction in our country. They are the biggest international bank that is funding the most fossil fuel companies in my country, the Philippines, which is ravaged by typhoons year after year. They've brought destruction to our doorstep, so we're here at their doorstep to demand for justice and to demand them to defund climate chaos.
For the next 2 weeks, we'll bring you comprehensive coverage of what's happening in Glasgow, as we have for every UN climate summit since Copenhagen in 2009, featuring voices inside the COP, that's the Conference of Parties, climate activists protesting outside, and advocates from the global south who couldn't travel to Scotland during the pandemic. Think of this as your global climate kitchen table, where we all gather round and discuss these critical issues. We begin our coverage by going inside the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow to speak with Asad Rehman. He's the executive director of War on Want and lead spokesperson for the COP26 coalition, which is hosting a counter summit next week in Glasgow. It's great to have you with us, Asad. Can you start off by setting the scene for us in just a few minutes, right after the broadcast of Democracy Now? President Biden will be addressing the global summit. The opening is happening as we speak right now. Lay out what the COP26 is all about and what you want to see come out of it, not to mention what happened with the G20.
So this climate summit has been billed, the 1.5 degree climate summit. And as we've heard, the window is closing on that target, which if we breach will spiral us into catastrophic climate change. But the reality is, as world leaders, particularly the richest countries, are coming with such weak pledges that this might as well be called the 3 degree summit. Not only are they not bringing the ambitious and fair share reductions that are needed to meet that target, but we've still, and you were there in Copenhagen over a decade ago when the Hillary Clinton made the promise on behalf of rich countries that poorer countries would have support of $100 billion each and every year by 2020. They're coming to this table with basically one-fifth of that on the table. Of that, 80% is in debt-creating loans. They're moving the goalposts on finance. They're refusing to accept liability for the impacts of their pollution on the rest of the world. And, you know, what we're seeing here is lots of tough talk on climate, but lack of plans, lack of policies, and refusal to put money on the table. So this is a very, very hugely disappointing climate negotiations. And especially now with many of the global south locked out of this negotiations in the first place, because we've seen how rich countries have responded to the global pandemic. And there's a lot of mistrust here. And I've been speaking to negotiators from many developing countries who're saying, look, if rich countries wouldn't even allow us to access and share COVID vaccine, when 10 million people have lost their lives around the world and hundreds of millions of people have been infected, when we've been spiraling into debt and they won't even take crisis, which is overwhelming us, how are we to trust them that they'll take action on climate change? What we're seeing here is really a lot of effort by the richest countries to want to carry on polluting. The UK and the US is coming here expanding its fossil fuels. We're in Scotland. The UK government has announced a massive expansion of North Sea oil and gas. It's got about another 36 projects in the pipeline. Those will triple the UK emissions. And similar story with the United States. It's very much a case of rich countries saying, don't do as I do, as I'm doing, do as I say, and trying to put the responsibility onto poorer countries to solve a crisis, obviously, they didn't cause, but that they're overwhelmingly being affected by.
So can you talk about what the COP26 coalition is that you are heading?
So the COP26 coalition has been the broadest and most widespread coalition that's ever come together here in the UK. It's brought together labour unions and faith organisations, from Black Lives Matter to climate strikers, yes, and the environmental and the and climate justice organisations. But what it's trying to do is build a movement of movements to recognise that the climate crisis is not simply an environmental crisis, it's an economic, social and racial and gender crisis as well. We know that the solutions to each of these crises are the same solutions, that we need to transform our energy and food systems away from systems based on exploitation and profit towards equitably sharing them. We need living wages and social protection, public services. We need to centre the realities of the global south in the urgency and the ambition. And this movement has been building for the last 2 years, really calling for a climate justice, a response both here in the negotiations but outside. And as your report mentioned, on November 6th, there's a global day of action with literally millions of people marching all over the world, very much with the same message. The era of injustice is over. We are calling not just on our leaders to act, but we want we want action that delivers justice. And there will be countless protests taking place here in the UK, and a massive one in Glasgow, but also similar protests in every corner of the world. Look, this fight around the climate crisis is not going to be won or lost here in this one summit. We've heard this before. As you said, in Copenhagen over a decade ago, we were told that was the most important COP. We're now told that this is the most important COP. We know that this transformation that needs to take place around the world is urgent. We know change is coming. The only now fight is what kind of change will it be? Who will pay the heaviest price? And will it actually deliver justice? And that's a fight that goes beyond this climate summit. It goes back to our local communities, into our workplaces, into our national context. But it needs to be connected and united in a much broader transition, so we have a justice transition for everybody who's been impacted and affected.
I want to turn to the Ugandan climate justice activist Vanessa Nakate, who spoke recently to Time magazine.
This is a country that has one of the fastest changing climates in the world. Because of the rising global temperatures, the weather patterns keep changing. And my country, Uganda, heavily depends on agriculture for survival for many communities, especially those in the rural areas. So it means a lack of rain means hunger, starvation and death for very many people. And extreme rainfall also means destruction. It means hunger, means starvation, and leaving many, many people homeless. Historically, Africa is responsible for only 3% of global emissions, and yet some Africans are already suffering some of the worst and brutal impacts of climate change. So what we really want is a future that is healthy, that is sustainable, that is clean, that is livable and equitable for all of us.
So that is Vanessa Nakate of Uganda. Her book, A Bigger Picture, My Fight to Bring a New African Voice to the Climate Crisis, is being published in the United States tomorrow. And she is the cover of Time magazine, which is called The Activist. Uganda's Vanessa Nakate dreams of a Green New Deal for everyone. If you could talk about what that means, and earlier you mentioned, Assad, the issue of people not getting in. Can you talk about the visa process and how difficult it is from the global south? We'll be talking with in just a few minutes. We're going to be going to Mozambique and talk more about this.
So I think this is one will go down as one of the poorest planned climate summits. It's been a summit that global civil society called for it to be postponed because we're in the midst of a health pandemic. We've seen the UK government as the host literally pay very, very little attention to the realities of people in the global south. We've seen many people unable to attend because, of course, the pandemic, be able to navigate their way through a hostile environment, immigration system here in the UK, and it's been left to civil society, to the COP26 coalition, to intervene, to try and bring people over, to help meet the extortionate costs of now attending the here in Glasgow, from price gouging on accommodation to quarantine hotels that were paid for and weren't paid for. I mean, literally, the UK government has moved the goalposts every single day. And if you saw the pictures outside of this summit this morning, it's absolutely chaotic, with people queuing for hours and hours to get into this summit. It's been poorly planned. There's been very, very little political leadership from the UK government. And what the UK government has brought to the table actually is a response to the climate crisis, which actually fuels the climate crisis. A few days before even this summit began, the UK government announced its own budget plans, and those budget plans included a massive expansion of aviation, a massive expansion of public subsidies to fossil fuel industries, more road building, when we actually needed the investments both in the UK and as a country which has cut its own aid budget earlier this year, desperately the finance that is needed for the Global South, as Vanessa said, so we can actually have a global Green New Deal, one that goes beyond our nation states, that isn't built on the same logic of extraction and exploitation of rich countries onto the poorer countries. It's all possible, and that's the voice of movements outside, the ones that have been locked out, and those of us from climate justice organisations who are in the inside. We are the ones who are going to be turning the dial. It's now up to people. It's people power is the only solution that's left. We've been here for 26 different climate summits. We know government leaders are still dragging their feet, because filling these holes are not people from the Global South. Filling these holes are corporate lobbyists, a big business, still peddling sort of fictitious solutions like carbon capture and storage, or unproven and risky technologies to suck carbon out of the atmosphere. Their message is carry on polluting, and sometime in the future we'll work out this solution. The reality is millions of people are already dying, their food system's being impacted. We've seen sea level rises, we've seen people being displaced. We can't bank on the business as usual. We need a massive transition. We need a huge change in the way that we approach this, and it can be a better, fairer and more equal world for everyone.
Finally, Asad Rehman, and then we head to Mozambique outside. But as we broadcast, we are showing live images. President Biden just came in, your Prime Minister, Boris Johnson, Prince Charles is also there. What is your message for them and those who aren't there, like China and Russia?
Look, simply by world leaders turning up is not going to solve the climate crisis. What matters is their actions and their policies. Look, we've seen the United States, of course, following the Trump administration, it's rejoined the Paris Agreement. But it's brought to the table here an increase in its finance pledges from 3 days of military spending to 6 days of military spending. It's licensing at home a massive expansion of fossil fuels. It's refusing to actually say we need to shift away from our fossil fuel addiction. Yes, these are small steps, but the reality is winning slowly on climate is the same as losing. We need much bolder, more ambitious positions and plans and policies. And that's what matters when these leaders come here, not the to opportunity, not the claiming of the climate leadership mantle. And that's what we've seen with President Biden, with Prime Minister Boris Johnson. Really, the only moral call that's coming here is from the Pope and from the UN Secretary General, who are who have time and time again have called out this lack of action, have called out this lack of just empty promises, and are urgently saying we have to respond. The lives of millions and billions of people are going to be impacted. And what we've got on the table here is far from what we need.
Asad Rehman, we want to thank you for being with us. Executive Director of War on Want, lead spokesperson for the COP26 coalition, standing inside the COP26, the UN Climate Summit. Next up, we're going to Mozambique to speak with a longtime climate campaigner, Dipti Bhatnagar, who had to stay home. We'll talk about this whitest and most privileged climate summit yet. Stay with us.
Standing there, killing time. Can't commit to anything but a crime. Leaders on vacation. An open invitation. Animals, evidence. Pearly gates look more like a picket fence. Once you get inside them. Got friends but can't invite them. Hills burn in California. My turn to ignore ya. Don't
don't say I didn't want you. All the good girls go to hell, 'cause even God herself has enemies. And once the water starts to rise and heaven's out of sight, she'll want the devil on her team. My love's so far is lonely. Look at you needing me. You know I'm not your friend without some greenery. Walking wearing feathers.
Go to Hell by Billie Eilish. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Some 30,000 people are expected to take part in the two-week UN climate summit in Glasgow. But many warn the gathering will be the whitest and the most privileged climate summit ever, with thousands from the global south unable to attend because of lack of access to COVID vaccines and visa issues. We go now to Mozambique, where we're joined by Dipti Bhatnagar, climate justice and energy coordinator at Friends of the Earth International. She is joining us from Maputo, and in a moment we'll be joined by her colleague, Mary Church of Glasgow, Scotland, inside the COP, where we will join them virtually. Dipti, thanks so much for being with us. It's great to have you with us. Usually we're together at the UN Climate Summit. Now we're providing that global kitchen table for people to sit around and discuss and debate the most critical issues of the day. Can you talk about why you're not at the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow this year?
Thanks, Amy. Great to be talking to you again. I definitely wish we were speaking in person, but this is what the pandemic has done. It's been absolutely devastating for so many people across the globe. And as Asad was saying, the organization of this COP has been very deliberately done by the UK government to be this really exclusionary space, because they know that if the people from the Global South, if the progressive civil society from the Global South are not there to hold people accountable in the halls of power, it's going to be a lot easier for them to get away with carbon markets, with not putting the finance on the table, not putting the emissions reductions on the table. So for so many people like me, I am so privileged compared to so many people around me here in Mozambique and in this continent of Africa. People have faced huge burdens to be able to get to the COP, and most people have just not managed. So the vaccine situation across this continent, you can quite imagine. People are calling it vaccine apartheid for a reason, Amy. People have not got access. I think the access rate in Mozambique currently is around 6 to 7% of people have access to the vaccine. And of course, the visa burdens have been huge. And the changing rules, Amy, constantly changing quarantine rules. So Mozambique was on the red list until a few weeks ago. And that was when, you know, we, Justiça Ambiental, Friends of the Earth Mozambique, myself, we made this decision that we're not going to be able to go, and things are constantly changing. And today, Amy, the red list has been ended by the UK, and those who were still on the red list, who were planning to go and do the managed quarantine, which was supposed to be paid for by the UK government, today the red list has ended. The quarantine hotel is not going to be paid anymore. So people who are already on their way have to now find accommodation of their own. This is just one example of the type of barriers that have been put on the table, for which reason so many people who usually go there, because the COP is an exclusive space at the best of times, but people who usually go there, many, many have not been able to make it. And that's why what is going to come out of this COP, because the people who need to be there, who need to hold people accountable, are not going to be there. Those who are there, we're in solidarity with our comrades who are on the ground there. But what is going to come out of this COP is going to be largely illegitimate because of the way that they've organized it and because of the intentions behind it.
Mm. Explain more what this red list is.
So the red list was a list of countries from which if you traveled to the UK, you had to quarantine for 5 days in England or 10 days in Scotland. And that was in a managed quarantine situation in a government hotel. And the UK government says, OK, we will cover the cost of the hotel. But for a woman like myself, I didn't feel safe being in someone else's space confined for 5 days, not knowing what the situation was. You know, for some people, it's quite normal. This quarantine situation has been normalized for people who are traveling. For us, it's not the case. And that's why it didn't feel safe to make those decisions. I understand that we're in a pandemic. We shouldn't be hosting this COP right now. I'm not saying, you know, that there shouldn't have been quarantine, because we need to protect also the people of Glasgow so that they don't have all these people coming into their city and you know, possibly causing a super spreader event. We don't want that. That's why, as Asad said, in early September, so many civil society organizations said, this is not the right time to have the COP, and the UK government, the way you've been organizing it. Amy, we don't know anyone who actually got the vaccines under the vaccine scheme that the UK government promised. I know lots of people who applied for it. I don't know a single person who actually got it. So these conditions leading up to the COP mean that it should not be held in this way. And the images from this morning, Amy, people trying to get into the conference center, forget about social distancing. People are just all over each other in the bitter cold, waiting to get in because of how badly this has been planned. And for us, it's not been planned badly just because. This is intentional so that the voices that are challenging those power relations don't get to be there or get to be weakened while they're there. That's the idea.
Yes, we almost didn't have Assad because he was in the security line for so long. But can you explain what net zero is and why you want to dismantle what you call the myth of net zero?
Absolutely. So this is being called the net zero COP because the UK government has, for the last 2 years, since the last COP happened in Madrid, has been trying to push this idea of net zero. And it sounds really nice to people. Okay, there's a zero in it. But net zero is not zero, because their entire idea, Amy, is that the polluters will keep polluting as long as they can sequester their emissions elsewhere. So it's about emitting and then pulling it out of the air. So the net still becomes zero. And the message that we're giving so many civil society across the world, there's a new website that has been launched today, Real Solutions, Not Net Zero. There's some dashes in there. This is a civil society effort to say no to net zero, because this is an escape hatch for polluters to continue polluting. And not only that, they're planning, where are they going to sequester these carbon emissions? They want the lands and the forests of communities in the global south who are using those resources. They want those. So this isn't just about, this is a rhetoric about the climate crisis, but it's also the financialization of nature and grabbing more lands and having more resources in the hands of corporations and the elites. And that is what we are totally against. Net zero is a Trojan horse also for geoengineering. This is really about all these unproven, untested, dangerous technologies that they're trying to trot out just because they do not want to change status quo. They do not want to reduce their emissions. So they're making us think that this is something that's going to help, but it's absolutely not. It's going to make things worse. That is why we're saying no to net zero, yes to real solutions, yes to system change.
And why are you concerned about the participation at the COP26 of Mark Carney, the UN Special Envoy for Climate Action, finance advisor to Prime Minister Boris Johnson, proponent of what's called a voluntary mechanism for scaling up carbon markets? What message do you have for him, Dipti?
Sure. So Mark Carney used to be the part of the Bank of England. So you get an idea of the type of people that Boris Johnson has put in place to lead this task force on scaling up voluntary carbon markets, as you were saying. Carbon markets is so linked to net zero because carbon markets is about trading pollution. So that's when you know that is their plan. They want to keep emitting and they need a mechanism to be able to trade carbon so that they can say, oh, someone else is sucking that carbon out of the air, so we're fine. So Article 6 negotiations, Amy, have broken down every year. The last time that we were there in Madrid, civil society gave a huge push against Article 6, against the carbon markets negotiations, and the negotiations broke down. So many of us who cannot be there this year, what it means is that they're actually planning to push Article 6 carbon markets and close the agreement this year. This part of the agreement, they have not managed to decide. since the Paris Agreement was signed 6 years ago. So people like Mark Carney, the where they come from, the role that they play here is really pushing so the idea is pushing carbon markets within the UNFCCC framework, within the Conference of the Parties framework, as well as the voluntary carbon markets that they're trying to push. It's all for financializing and commodifying nature. It's for pretending to do something on the climate crisis, but not doing it while they strengthen financial markets on nature and grab lands. This is really the game that they're playing here.
So we're talking.
Our people are going to be there to oppose it.
We're talking to Dipti Bhatnagar, who is climate justice and energy coordinator at Friends of the Earth International. She is with us from Maputo, Mozambique. And although you may see this oak table here in New York, it is very expansive today. We wanted to link everyone, people around the globe who can't make it to the summit, people who are not accredited at the COP, and so they're outside the summit walls and can't go in these extremely long security lines, and people at the center of the COP. And that's where we're going to go right now, to join Dipti with her colleague, Mary Church. You see, as Scotland is hosting the UN Climate Summit in Glasgow, plans for a huge oil field off the coast of Scotland are set to go ahead. And we're continuing our coverage of the two-week UN Climate Summit inside the COP with Mary Church, head of campaigns. She's in the same organization as Dipti Bhatnagar, Friends of the Earth, and she heads Friends of the Earth Scotland. You can say hi to Dipti, Mary. You're separated by, to say the least, many miles, but certainly not by your concerns for the planet. Place us in Glasgow, Scotland, where many have never been in their whole lives.
Yeah, so, I mean, Glasgow is the biggest city in Scotland, and it's got a long history of social movements and really, powerful movements in and we're seeing that growing, we're seeing that coming to life, really, around this climate summit in a really fantastic way.
So, can you talk about what it means that Dipti can't come, that this climate summit, unlike last year when it was canceled, is being held in the midst of a pandemic, and that what you're trying to bring into the COP from outside, from Scotland, and the struggles you're dealing with there?
Yeah, so the UK government was talking up this COP as being the most inclusive COP ever, despite, you know, going ahead with it while the pandemic, while the COVID-19 pandemic rages around the world. And far from the most inclusionary summit, we're seeing the opposite of that, right? So we're seeing absolutely the most exclusive climate summit ever, the most white, the most privileged climate summit. So we in civil society movements, in Friends of the Earth and in the COP coalition, we called for the COP to be postponed because we didn't think it was safe to go ahead, given the really quite high rates of COVID here in the UK, right, here in Scotland, here in the central belt of Scotland, but also around the world, and obviously also to do with the COVID vaccine apartheid. So, you know, seeing the very, very unequal rollout of the COVID vaccine globally, you know, the continent of Africa, for example, has less than 5% coverage of vaccination. And yeah, people in the UK, people here in Scotland, we've got quite a high level of vaccination, but the virus is still circulating at really high rates. So we don't think it was safe to go ahead with the conference. The UK government has pushed ahead with that anyway. Their preparations for the COP, the logistics for the COP, I mean, I think Dipti and Asad have touched on this. The preparations have been last minute. They've been chaotic and shambolic. They've been ever-changing. It's almost as if, you know, as Dipti says, they didn't really want the peoples of the Global South to be able to make it, to be able to have their voices heard. So part of what we've been doing in Scottish civil society and UK civil society, we've been organising as part of this broad, diverse movement of movements that's coming together under the COP26 coalition. We've been organising over the two last years, actually, because the COP was announced two whole years ago, right? So we've had a good run up to this to get together, to get to know each other, to do learning within our movements. So we've been organizing together to make sure that A, we can support as many people as possible to come to Glasgow in as safe a way as possible. So we set up a visa support service and a sort of travel support service, and we have helped many hundreds of people to come to Glasgow that way. But we also know of many hundreds, if not thousands, of people, so civil society delegates, people who would have been inside the talks, people who would have come to be making their voices heard on the streets outside of the talks as well as party delegates who have been unable to come to Glasgow and attend these talks. And one of the ways we're trying to mitigate against that through our work here in Glasgow and around the UK is we're doing all of our the civil society activities that we're planning. So we have an alternative summit, you know, a counter summit, a people summit planned for the middle Sunday to Wednesday, so Sunday the 7th to Wednesday the 10th. That summit will be run in a hybrid way, right, so that people who haven't been able to travel to Glasgow from the Global South can still get their voices heard through that summit, yeah? So we'll be doing everything that we can in this dual sort of in-person and a hybrid way.
So on Sunday, climate justice activists interrupted COP26 President Alok Sharma at the closing ceremony of the Youth Summit. This is what he said and what happened.
And on every occasion,
Alok Sharma, you are a hypocrite. What do we want?
What do
we want?
No!
What do we want?
Climate justice!
What do we want? What do we want?
The interruption of Alok Sharma, the COP president, while he was speaking, and they're saying Alok Sharma and the UK government are hypocrites. They're opening the new Cambo oil field. They subsidize billions into fossil fuels and yet won't look after the workers that need a just transition. Mary Church, can you explain what exactly they're talking about?
Yeah, so the Cambo oil field is a big new find off the west coast of Shetland. So it's an oil field that would be planned to be running until 2050, right? We know that fossil fuels need to be phased out long, long, long before 2050. But this proposal is to keep on drilling oil until 2050. Over the lifespan of the development, it would be 800 million barrels of oil. Now, that's the equivalent of 10 years of Scotland's annual emissions, yeah? And this is a proposal by Shell and Siccar Point Energy, and it's seeing an awful lot of opposition. So, yeah, there's a really strong movement growing to stop Cambo. This is a UK government decision, so the oil field is based off the coast of Scotland. It's a UK government decision. You know, it's had an initial exploration licence, and now there's the decision that needs to be made as to whether the project can go forward into development, right, into actual extraction of the oil. So that's the decision that the UK government ministers are sort of poised to make. As we understand it, they're poised to green light that, right? They haven't made the decision before COP, perhaps understandably because of all the criticism, if they were to go ahead with it, that would come with that. And, you know, only yesterday we saw the Scotland Secretary, so that's a UK government post, but we saw the Scotland Secretary, Alistair Jack, saying 100% the Cambo field needs to go ahead, which is, you know, absolute hypocrisy. So UK government claims this mantle of climate leadership. And, you know, even the IEA, the International Energy Agency, has said, you know, they're not exactly the most sort of radical organisation on the planet, but even the IEA, the International Energy Agency, have said, you know, no more fossil fuels, no more investment in fossil fuels if we want to have any chance of limiting warming to that critical 1.5 threshold. So it's almost unthinkable that the presidency, you know, the UK as presidents of this COP that's pitted as, you know, being pitted as the last chance to turn things around and avoid 1.5, is even contemplating greenlighting a project of this scale. And I would like to also say, you know, the Scottish government, you know, it's not a Scottish government decision to give the go-ahead to Cambo. But, you know, and our First Minister here in Scotland, Nicola Sturgeon, you know, she is perhaps a more credible voice on the climate than Boris Johnson, for example. But even Nicola Sturgeon hasn't actually said no to the Camberwell oil field, right? We've seen some welcome moves from the Scottish Government recently. So last Monday, the First Minister signalled that the Scottish Government could no longer support this UK-wide policy of maximising economic recovery of oil and gas, right? That is written into UK law, right? Maximising economic recovery of gas, squeezing every last drop out of the North Sea, right? And finally, Scottish Government have stood up and said, OK, that is incompatible with meeting our climate target. So that is a small but important, really welcome move from the Scottish Government. But what we need to see now is Sturgeon going further and supporting a ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure, all new fossil fuel projects, saying no to Cambo, being, you know, really outright in opposition to Cambo, and moving on. You mentioned just transition earlier, so really moving on from the rhetoric on just transition and actually delivering on a just transition for the workers and the communities whose livelihoods are really dependent on the oil and gas industry, you know, at the UK level, but particularly in Scotland, right? The North Sea oil and gas industry is a hugely important part of the national economy. So how do we make sure that those workers and communities, you know, that their experiences, their skills, their knowledge is at the centre of how we move away from fossil fuels to a renewable energy economy, and also that they're protected, right? Their livelihoods are protected as we do that transition. Because, you know, we've seen energy transitions in this country before, right? We've seen the closure of the coal mines, you know, in the 80s and of the 90s and all the rest of it. And we've seen the way that those communities were treated, right? They were abandoned. They were left to sort it out for themselves. And we've seen, you know, the impacts of that over many decades, yeah, in terms of social dislocation and all the problems that have come with that. So we absolutely need to not do that this time, you know, get it right and do a, you know, deliver a real just transition.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Mary Church, head of campaigns at Friends of the Earth International Scotland, and Dipti Bhatnagar, speaking to us from Maputo, Mozambique, climate justice energy coordinator, Friends of the Earth International. Two women environmental leaders, so many women leaders of the climate movement, from Greta Thunberg in Sweden to Vanessa Nakate in Uganda. We must forefront those voices and so many others. As inside the COP, Mary stands in front of a moving globe. Next up, we're going to look at the shocking torture of a former U.S. resident in CIA black sites and how military jurors who heard him speak at Guantanamo say that his treatment is a stain on the moral fiber of America. Stay with us.
When it's hot, it's hot. When it's not, it's not. You don't know what you got till you lose the plot. Hooter ain't nothing dumber than driving an Hummer in this monsoon summer. You're gonna need a plumber. You can't turn back, 'cause it's getting oh so warm. Things are looking black, this is the calm.
Calm Before the Storm by World Beat. I'm Amy Goodman. This is the War and Peace Report. And remember, you can turn to us for so many of the climate actions that will be taking place over the next 2 weeks. And if you go to democracynow.org, we will link to today's opening ceremony inside the COP. But today, we end looking at the U.S. torture program. Seven senior military officers who served on a jury at a trial at Guantanamo have written an extraordinary letter decrying the CIA's torture program, describing it as a stain on the moral fiber of America. The officers had served on the jury of the case of Majid Khan, a former resident of Maryland who was tortured in CIA black sites for years after being detained in Pakistan. On Thursday, Khan became the first Guantanamo prisoner to describe in an open court the CIA's torture methods at its black sites. For more than 2 hours, Majid Khan described force feedings, waterboarding, other physical and sexual abuse he endured, including extended periods of nudity, while he was detained in the CIA's network of overseas prisons from 2003 to 2006. On Friday, Majid Khan, who's admitted to being a courier for al-Qaeda, was sentenced to 26 years, but under a deal he scheduled for release in February. In the letter, the military jurors wrote, quote, Mr. Khan was subjected to physical and psychological abuse well beyond approved enhanced interrogation techniques, instead being closer to torture performed by the most abusive regimes in modern history. We are joined now by Bahar Azmi. He is legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights, which helped represent Majid Khan. Bahar, thanks for coming back on Democracy Now! Can you talk about the significance of this testimony? Today's New York Times front page, military jurors rebuke torture as moral stain.
Thank you, Amy, for making time to cover this remarkable story. This is the first proceeding under the military commissions process where a survivor of the U.S. torture program actually got to testify under agreed upon procedures in the military commission system. It's actually jurors that hear the sentencing, and they were selected, as any jurors would be, for impartiality and a lack of familiarity with the case. And what they heard was a young man describe how in his early 20s he was impressionable and went awry. But Majid Khan, to his credit, detailed the systematic, brutal, sadistic torture of U.S. government officials, namely the CIA, which for nearly 20 years the U.S. government has tried to keep secret. But to the credit of Majid Khan and his lawyers, they leveraged this proceeding to get some form of redress for his torture, namely a reduced sentence because of the admission around his brutal torture, and open testimony where he could speak to the public, to his family who saw him for the first time, and to military officials who are utterly repulsed by the conduct of the United States government.
So tell us what happened to him and the number of cases you represented around him.
Well, he was one of a number of what the CIA called high-value detainees who were, you know, spirited to one of the numerous overseas secret detention sites, subject to CIA superintendents and interrogation, and tortured and tortured and tortured, even as he was sharing information and cooperating. They believed in the perverse logic of this authoritarian regime. That was only proof that he had more information to give. And then he was ultimately transferred to Guantanamo in 2006 after the Supreme Court intimated that holding people in secret CIA detention would violate the Geneva Conventions. It's at that point the Center for Constitutional Rights chose to represent him among, you know, nearly two dozen other detainees in different parts of the U.S. detention program. And he and his lawyers fought consistently to get some sort of recognition and documentation about his torture. And over again, a little bit more of the iceberg was revealed. And as much as he was able to share, it's still just the top part of the iceberg. The Senate Select Intelligence Report regarding torture hasn't been fully declassified. We need to hear from other victims of the CIA torture program, and we need more meaningful accountability for what the United States government did to Majid and many dozens of other detainees in the so-called global war on terror.
Majid accused CIA medics of raping him through rectal feeding.
Yeah, that's been documented, and there's a level of sadism here that happened when the United States abandoned any commitment to legal constraint and turned over. I mean, I think what's interesting here is that this is the U.S. military jurors selected from the United States military expressing revulsion for the conduct of civilians who ordered the torture, namely Rumsfeld, Cheney, Bush, John Yoo, and other, like, repellent, so far unaccountable individuals from the Bush administration, judging them for violating basic legal and humanitarian norms.
Bob Rosmi, we just really have 30 seconds. Yeah. It is expected Majid will be released in February. 38 men will remain at Guantanamo. What is the Biden administration doing? Are they going to close Guantanamo?
I think they are supposedly working behind the scenes, but they need to do far more to ensure the safe release and transfer of all 38 detainees, including Majid Khan. And in his case, to be sent to a place where he's free, will have emotional, psychological support and connection to his family.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Bahar Azmi, legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is currently accepting application for a director of finance administration, also a human resources manager. Check it out at democracynow.org. And stay with us throughout these 2 weeks. Democracy Now! Is your place for the UN Climate Summit and everywhere around the world. I'm Amy Goodman.
Mark G. of the Evolution Control Committee, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, where the drunken pants are going wild.
This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we talk with the author of Democracy in Chains, the deep history of the radical right's stealth plan for America.
Nancy McLean puts it all together. This is like a evolving coup that's going on now. The bad guys are halfway there.
The Federalist Society has shifted the United States' political and legal landscape to the right. Joining us today is Michael Avery, attorney and author of The Federalist Society, How Conservatives Took the Law Back from Liberals. He'll tell us how this happened. Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm New York City attorney and activist Heidi Boghossian.
The spectacle of Donald Trump and the palace intrigue in the White House has served daily to distract people from the political strategy and accomplishments of the radical right, which is taking over the Republican Party. Over time, the GOP has been transformed into an operation conducting a concerted effort to curb democratic rule in favor of capitalist interests in every branch of the government, whatever the consequences. It is marching ever closer to the ultimate goal of reshaping our Constitution to protect moneyed interests. This gradual takeover of a major political party happened steadily over several decades and often in plain sight. Duke Professor Nancy McLean exposes the architecture of this change and its ultimate aim. She has written that, quote, both my research and my observations as a citizen lead me to believe American democracy is in peril. Her book, Democracy in Chains, The Deep History of the Radical Right's Stealth Plan for America, has become an intellectual flashpoint and caused her to become the victim of a coordinated right-wing attack. She tells the long-overlooked story of James Buchanan, the political economist who developed the playbook for Charles Koch and his brother and their web of billionaires and millionaires who, beginning in the mid-2000s, have become a force to reckon with. To talk about the subversion of our democratic system from within is Professor Nancy McLean.
Nancy McLean, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. I'm happy to be with you.
The Republican Party has been transformed both locally and nationally. It's no longer the party that, as you wrote, my father used to vote for.
Today we're hoping to explore how the Republican Party has become an instrument of the far right. You argue that key to this story, what you call the missing piece, is understanding the rise of the billionaire radical right and its radical impact on our politics. There's a man named James McGill Buchanan. Tell us about him and how you learned about him.
Yes, well, what I learned is that James McGill Buchanan's ideas are what enabled Charles Koch to break through in his quest for radical transformation of our institutions after decades of pretty much ineffectual work on the margins. James McGill Buchanan was the first Nobel Prize winner to have been born in the U.S. South and to have worked most of his life in Southern institutions. He was the founder of a new school of thought called public choice economics, which is actually a broader tradition that includes people like Cass Sunstein, who worked for President Obama, and others. But his particular variant of that public choice school was the Virginia School of Political Economy, and he was always preoccupied with critiquing democracy as it existed in his early years, and then ultimately with prescribing measures by which it could be, in his words, enchained. And it was those ideas that Charles Koch picked up.
And what did Koch do to fund Buchanan? Can you talk a bit about the network of organizations and think tanks that Koch has set up?
Yes. Well, Koch, for years, was the single biggest funder on the radical libertarian right by a long stretch. So anybody who was on the libertarian right and looking for money went to Charles Koch. Now, James Buchanan, from his first years in Virginia in the late 1950s, had also broader corporate